Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Mantras, Sound of the Sacred World by Lama Kathy Wesley. Buddhist teachings say we all possess the potential for enlightenment or Buddhahood, called Buddha nature, and thus all beings are worthy of respect. But how do we key into that sacred nature hidden so deeply within our minds? The practice of mantra opens the door to a world of the sacred within us and gives us a view of how the outer world could manifest if we viewed it through awakened eyes. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good afternoon. Today's talk is Mantras, Sound of the Sacred World. And part of the reason that I decided to talk on this particular topic was because I remember when I was first getting interested in Buddhism and I was trying to learn about Tibetan Buddhism in particular, there were a few things I didn't exactly understand. I had a sense that mantra practice was important. And I had a sense that mantra practice was powerful because when I first started attending the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Center in Columbus, Ohio, like 40 years ago, the main practice we did was the practice of Chenrezig, the Bodhisattva of Compassion. And I knew there was something incredibly special about it. The next day when I would go to work, people would say, "What did you do last night?" Or I said, "Well, I'm going to church." And they said, "Well, whatever you're doing, keep doing it because we love you on Fridays." So I guess you could say that from my own personal experience with mantra, mantra practice helped me a lot. It helped me to get into the practice of meditation because as a person who has been sort of nervous person my whole life. I've been kind of nervous and anxious my whole life. Quiet sitting was not happening for me at first. It just was not easy for me. But when I started doing mantra practice, it was as though something clicked. And I came to understand myself and my potential to be a helper to other beings, because that was the way mantra was explained to me, that it was a way of working with my own mind so that I could calm down the grosser mental afflictions. And by calming down the grosser mental afflictions through taming the mind, through reciting the mantra, that I would be, I would have the potential to become a better person. So that I completely understood that, and I practiced it, and I found great benefit from doing mantra. So I thought I would do a talk about that today. If we look at how mantra figures into basic Buddhist teaching, we have to go back to the teachings that are called the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma. And the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma are a way of categorizing and classifying the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha gave three specific cycles of instruction. The first cycle of instruction, he taught mainly the benefits of mindfulness and the benefits of quiet sitting meditation to calm the mind and to center the mind so that we could begin to work with our experience of the world. Because in the Buddha's earliest teachings, his book of sayings, the Dharmapada, says, "We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts we make the world." And so the Buddha really established right away in his teachings that it is through our mind that we experience the world, and it's through our mind that we come in contact with the world. And so in a way, we are the creators of our own experience of the world. And so so through the original teachings, the earliest teachings of the Buddha, he taught mindfulness. And he also taught ethical behavior, because he said that when the mind is disturbed, when the mind is roiling with mental afflictions, jealousy or anger or sadness, when the mind is roiling with all of these mental afflictions, it's extremely difficult for the mind to come to a state of peace. And so the Buddha equated virtue, that is taking an active role in taking care of oneself and taking an active role in helping others. He identified virtuous mind states as being relatively more calm in meditation than non-virtuous mind states. And in fact, he taught extensively about what he called the 10 virtuous actions as opposed to the 10 unvirtuous actions. Now, I didn't intend to talk about the virtuous actions and non-virtuous actions today, but I will mention briefly that if we look at the virtuous acts, they bring about peace of mind. And if we talk about the non-virtuous acts, they bring about a lack of peace of mind. And so the non-virtuous action, for example, would be bringing an end to life or killing. The virtuous action would be saving lives. The non-virtuous action would be telling lies. The virtuous action would be being truthful and gentle. And then in the mind, for example, ill will is considered a non-virtuous mind state, and the virtuous mind state is to foster a feeling of goodwill toward all. So if we look at these three types of mental afflictions, the afflictive states that are associated with the body, the afflictive states that are associated with the speech, and the mental afflictions that are associated with the mind, body, speech, and mind, if we take part in non-virtuous actions, thoughts and words, then we have less peace of mind. And if we undertake more positive and virtuous states of mind, then we will have more inner peace. So these were the very earliest teachings of the Buddha. And this was called his first turning of the wheel of Dharma. The other thing that the Buddha pointed out in his earliest teachings was he talked about the self and who we are as individuals. I guess the question, who am I and why am I here, has been part of humanity since the beginning of humanity. And so coming to an understanding of who or what a human being is and what a human being is capable of doing and experiencing, this is fundamental for all of us since forever. So the Buddha said that all of us have the potential to become the very best versions of ourselves. We can become awakened beings or enlightened beings, or we can experience what the Buddha called Buddhahood. Buddhahood is an understanding of the true nature of everything. And so in this first turning of the wheel of Dharma, the first thing the Buddha taught was that the self, or our self concept, was not a unitary thing, but was actually an amalgam or an amalgamation of some smaller things. The reason this was a significant innovation in his thinking and teaching is because at that time, it was thought that all human beings were created by a creator, and that creator put the sentient beings through a series of trials, and that this series of trials were aimed at bringing that sentient being to perfection. And then once the sentient being had reached a state of perfection, they could be reabsorbed into the creator, and that this was the function of self from the tradition in India that the Buddha grew from. There was a tradition or a teaching called Atman, or the self. And this self was thought to be permanent and unchanging. But the Buddha, in his teaching and understanding of the self, he taught that the self was not a unitary thing, and that was actually made of smaller pieces. And these smaller pieces he called the five heaps, or the five aggregates. He said that the self could not be considered a unitary thing because it was composed of smaller parts, such as our form, the form that we have, our physical form, feelings, the feelings that physical form has, perception, how we perceive and interface with the world, mental formation, that is all of the background, all of the our habitual patterns and thoughts, and then finally our consciousness, which is all of those factors together experiencing the world. And so part of the reason that the Buddha spent so much time in this first turning of the wheel of Dharma talking about what he called anatman or non-self was a way of encouraging his listeners to think that they themselves might have within their power the power to reveal their own inner nature and to experience their own inner nature as awakening, as Buddha. And so this idea that self was an amalgam was an important point. And so in the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, the Buddha taught the emptiness of self, or the limitlessness of self. You could say that the self has no color, no shape, no location, no beginning, no end, and therefore it's truly limitless. But yet we grasp and cling onto that self as though it were real. So this first turning of the wheel of Dharma, the Buddha taught the selflessness of self, or the non-solidity of self. It's not that the self doesn't exist. We do have a sense of self. It's right there. We can see it. But that it is not what we think it is. It's not unitary. It's not unchanging. It is made of the five aggregates, and it is constantly in a state of change. In fact, the Buddha, rather than talking about soul, he talked about a stream of being. He said we were a stream of being that was constantly changing. Now you might say, what was the function of teaching in this first turning of the wheel? What was the Buddha trying to accomplish? And he was trying to accomplish an explanation of how sentient beings, how human beings experience this world, and also how we could change how we experience this world by changing how we see ourselves. And so this first turning of the wheel, it was, I guess you could call it an eye-opener, and that we were not what we thought we were, and that we could actually become so much more. And that if we knew ourselves in our completeness and knew who we were, that we then would actually be able to experience the world with purity and compassion and wisdom as the Buddha himself experienced it. But the Buddha didn't stop there. His audience began to evolve and his teaching began to evolve. So in the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, the Buddha felt that his audience was now ready to understand the nature, not just of the self concept, but the nature of all reality. And so he began to teach the limitless nature of all phenomena. And he did this by teaching on emptiness. Now, we've talked here about emptiness before, and I've quoted His Eminence, Thai Sita Rinpoche, the great contemporary Kagyu master, who is the tutor of the 17th Karmapa. I've quoted him as saying that he's not crazy about the word emptiness, because for him, the English word emptiness often implies the number zero, or non-existence, or nihilism. And so he prefers to say that instead of mind being empty, it is limitless. And he also said that the nature, he said the emptiness of all phenomena could also be called the limitlessness of all phenomena. What the Buddha taught when he taught this second turning of the wheel of Dharma was that all of these things surrounding us, all of the objects that we experience in our everyday world, all of these objects themselves were uncreated, meaning they didn't create themselves, and that therefore they were impermanent, and being impermanent, they were continuously in a state of change. I know that when I was a child learning about glass in science class, I was so fascinated to hear that glass is continuously moving. It's always moving, and it's always changing, and it's, I guess you could say, it's kind of falling apart in front of us. The electrons are changing. All of the atomic structures are changing, which is why early American glass windows that you see in antique stores, sometimes the glass actually looks like it has changed and moved, like like a semi-solid liquid. It's a fascinating principle, but that our minds are not solid. They are constantly changing. And all phenomena also is constantly changing. And so as such, why should we cling not just to our self-concept? Why should we cling? It's always changing. Why do we cling to any object? It's not necessary. And in fact, it's not really holding to the truth. Now, where this is really important is in the teaching on and where the teaching of impermanence really comes in handy with material things is that material things can change. They can disappear. This glass could get broken. And so then we would feel disappointment because we lost something that we thought we owned. When my original Mickey Mouse watch broke, I was very disappointed. But what I did was I went out and got another one. But not every time is that going to be possible. There may be a future time when there are no Mickey Mouse watches. And so I have to have the sense that no matter what happens and no matter what timepiece I am wearing, everything is actually fine all the time. And so coming to this place of peace with the continuous change in external circumstances, the continual change in phenomena, this was the point of the second turning of the wheel of Dharma. Not just that we should understand the changing characteristics of self, but that we should also understand the changing characteristics of phenomena. And then finally, in the third turning of the wheel of Dharma, the Buddha took a radical turn. He said, it's not that all things are empty and therefore all things don't matter. Because that's one of the things that people could come to. That's one of the misunderstandings or one of the conclusions that a person could come to. That because things don't exist the way we think they do, nothing matters. And that one should be able to do whatever one wants without any worries. Well, This goes against the Buddha's original teaching from the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, where he said karma was a real fact. It's relatively true. Until we become a Buddha, we are continuously accumulating karma. And as long as we are clinging to our self-concept, we are always conditioning our self-concept with all of our thoughts and actions and words. And when we condition our mind with our thoughts, actions, and words, we're actually changing how we experience the world. And so the Buddha's the function of the Buddha's teaching was to show us the process so that we could begin to participate in the process instead of struggling against the process. So in order to remind people that there was actually purpose to human life, to remind people that there was a state of Buddhahood that one could accomplish, the Buddha reminded in the third turning of the wheel of Dharma, he reminded all of his listeners that emptiness did not imply a vacuum, but that there was a spontaneous presence, a basic goodness. We'd now call it Tathagata Garbha or Buddha nature, that all things, the self and the nature of all things, was something called Dharmakaya. Dharma means truth and kaya means body. So all things partake of the nature of truth. All things are empty and yet they appear. And so we have a mind that can experience itself, and that mind is empty of limitation, empty of color, shape, location, beginning, or end. And yet, spontaneously and continuously, that mind experiences. It experiences when we are awake. It experiences when we're sleeping and dreaming. It experiences at all times. And that experiential quality of the mind, the Buddha called it luminosity. This luminosity of mind, this Buddha nature. Emptiness is empty of everything except Buddha nature. And that's the point of the third turning of the wheel of Dharma, that emptiness is empty of everything except Buddha nature, that Buddha nature is the one permanent constant. In fact, in some of the Tibetan traditions, they call Dharmakaya the great permanence, which got them into trouble by some philosophers who said, so if you're calling the Dharmakaya, the basic nature of all things, as great permanence, aren't you believing in God? Aren't you asserting that there is a supreme God somewhere? But of course, the Buddhists would answer that by saying that the only thing that's permanent is this Dharmakaya. The basic nature of things is all that is truly permanent. The exterior circumstances are always changing, but the story behind the story, the truth behind the story, is permanent and unchanging and always there. So, but then of course you get into, and of course they said that this was not an entity, and that's why they asserted that they did not believe in deism or theism, because they didn't assert that Dharmakaya was a being, but rather the continuous perfect state of all things. And Kempo Kartha Rinpoche was asked about this one time. They said, well, do Tibetan Buddhists believe in God? And he gave what I call a lawyer's answer. He said, if you think that God is a person with a personality who has likes and dislikes and lives somewhere, he said, you could say we don't believe in that. But if you think that God is the inexpressible, ultimate nature of all things, he said, we believe in that. So, by talking about these three turnings of the wheel of Dharma today, this is serving as an introduction to introduce you to the idea of why mantra exists. Because mantra was taught by the Buddha during the third turning of the wheel of Dharma. And in teaching mantra, the Buddha actually began teaching the mantras during the second turning of the wheel. But in the third turning, they took on a more meaning. And that additional meaning is that they were the sound of the sacred nature of all things. Now, remember, we were talking a few minutes ago about self. We all have a sense of ourselves. We have a body. We have speech and we have mind. And as having body, speech, and mind, then we manifest in this world. But how do we manifest? Well, right now we are manifesting out of all of our habitual tendencies and all of our confusions from beginningless time until now. The Buddha posited that each of us has a mind, and that mind was never created by anyone and has always existed from the no beginning of time and always will exist to the no ending of time. And that mind will go through a series of experiences, and that through those experiences and through the practice of spiritual discipline, such as meditation and virtuous action and so on, that mind can refine itself to the place where it knows itself completely. It knows itself completely and attains liberation from all confusion. This is called Buddhahood or enlightenment. So the purpose of the Buddha's teaching was to alert us, number one, in the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, that self was not what we thought it was. It's not unchanging. It was not created, and so forth and so on. And so in the first turning of the wheel, he said, our self-concept is without solid existence. And then in the second turning of the wheel, he said phenomena did not have permanent existence. And then in the third turning, he said that the only thing that is permanent is the nature, this inexpressible nature of all things, this empty nature of all things. And that by coming to recognize the empty nature of mind, we would also instantly recognize the empty nature of all things. And the outgrowth of this, according to the teachings of the Buddha, is unbearable compassion. In other words, if a person comes understanding of the nature of their own minds at the deepest level, the reaction will be unbearable compassion for sentient beings who don't realize this. And so you read about mantra practice, there's a quotation that comes to mind, and that is the Dharmakaya through compassion manifests as the two kayas of form. And so the Dharmakaya, which is the body of truth, meaning the truth of emptiness, also can be experienced. The Dharmakaya can be experienced by ordinary beings like us, either as a physical human body. Great beings such as Holiness the Dalai Lama are examples of this Nirmanakaya, or the body of form, the enlightened form. And then the Sambhogakaya is called the body of complete enjoyment, but sometimes it's called the body of good qualities. And so this is how sentient beings who themselves have arrived at some level of Buddhahood, at some level of awakening, experience enlightened beings. The majority of us who are unenlightened, and our karma doesn't permit us to see the Sambhogakaya or experience the Dharmakaya directly, we see the Nirmanakaya forms of the great teachers who move among us and teach us. But the Sambhogakaya is how those teachers are experienced by those who are on the Bodhisattva levels of awakening. So the practice of mantra then has to do with our body, our speech, and our mind. So body, speech, and mind are how we experience ourselves. Body, speech, and mind is how we experience the world. And so the practice of mantra then is a way of engaging our body, engaging our speech, and engaging our mind so that we can accomplish the uncovering or the unmasking of our Buddha nature. I'm going to be working from a document that is called A Brief Discussion of Development and Fulfillment Stage Meditation, that's on my website, www.lamakathy.net. You can go to lamakathy.net, click on teachings, and then download this teaching called A Brief Discussion of Development and Fulfillment Stage Meditation. And the reason I'm calling it development and fulfillment is because we have to have a method to uncover our Buddha nature. We can't just snap our fingers magically and say, okay, I'm an enlightened being now. I have Buddha nature now. I know I have completely purified all of my confusion about the world. I've completely purified all my confusion about the self and reality and so on. We can't just snap our fingers and say, I'm a Buddha now. It doesn't work like that, because we have all of these persistent habits of reifying ourselves, reifying the world, and so on. And so what we have to do through our Dharma practice is come to a place where we can gradually dispel our confusion. And we have to do this bit by bit by bit through the repetition of specific methods. So we have to have a method. And so the work of the Buddhist path then is transforming our confusion about the world into primordial awareness or Buddhahood, coming to know our own nature. Now, theoretically, you can see how this can be accomplished. In our ordinary state, our mind is clouded and confused about the nature of everything. I was just reading today in Mingyur Rinpoche's book, Joyful Wisdom, where he says we're like people walking around in a dark room, bumping into all the furniture, until one day we accidentally bump into the light switch and turn on the lights and see that we were bumping around in a dark room unnecessarily. And this is, I think, what the Buddha's audiences always felt when he was teaching, because when he taught the Four Noble Truths, suffering and its cause and the nature of it and self-clinging and self-fixation and how letting go of all that brings happiness, it was as though it accidentally hit that light switch and seen all of their self-created suffering, how all of that came to be and how all of that could potentially be dispelled. And so theoretically, it's easy to understand. In our ordinary state, our mind is clouded and confused. But if we recognize our mind's true nature, we experience our primordial mind, our primordial awareness. However, on the practical level, this doesn't happen automatically or instantly. We have to use skillful means to transform our discursive thinking and all of our conceptuality that is keeping us in samsara. We have to transform all of that confusion into the experience of primordial awareness. So we have to use skillful means to transform ourselves. In the teachings of the third turning of the Wheel of Dharma and the outgrowth of this, the Vajrayana teachings, one such skillful means is development and fulfillment stage meditation. In Tibetan, the words for these are K-Y-E, Rim, R-I-M, for development, and Dzog, D-Z-O-G, Rim, R-I-M, for fulfillment. K-Rim for development, Dzogrim for fulfillment. So we have they're named this because what we do in this meditation, in mantra meditation, is we first imagine an enlightened world. And then we ourselves accept purification and uncover theoretically and with our imagination. We imagine that we're an enlightened being for the period of time that we're doing the meditation. And so we use these three faculties of body, speech, and mind, and we transform them through our imagination by imagining ourselves as a Buddha, our body as a Buddha, our speech as mantra, and our thought as primordial awareness. And therefore, we use in the Vajrayana all three faculties. We purify our notions, our incorrect notions about our body. We purify our notions about our speech, and we purify our notions about our mind. For example, physical body, we're very attached to it. We think of it as being a pure, permanent, and real. We look in the mirror, we worry about it, and so on. But our body is only temporary. This confusion about our body and this preoccupation with the body obstructs the arising of primordial awareness. So we must come to see that our body is something that appears without having self-nature. And so the body then is the form aspect of consciousness. So in Vajrayana, we identify with a pure and enlightened form, such as the Bodhisattva Chenrezig, the Bodhisattva of compassion, or Tara, the Bodhisattva of compassionate action, or Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, and so on. We set aside our concept of our body and take on the concept of a body of a Buddha being made of light. And we think of this body as being empty inside and yet luminous. Now, if you think about it, this actually makes a lot of sense because from the teachings of the Buddha, our mind is empty of limitation and yet it experiences. And that experiential nature is called clarity or luminosity. And so when we visualize ourselves as a Buddha or Bodhisattva made of light and empty inside, this is a way of symbolically meditating on our form as being, by meditating on our form as being emptiness and luminosity, we're meditating symbolically on the nature of our mind as emptiness and luminosity. Now, if we can completely identify with this form of a Buddha or Bodhisattva, the experience that we have when we fully identify with this body of a Bodhisattva is called the unity of appearance and emptiness. Now, the second faculty that we have that is confused, but then is purified through this K-Rim and Dzogrim, or this development and fulfillment meditation, is speech. In the development part of meditating on the body, we exchange the idea of a solid, real and unchanging body for the body made of light of a Buddha or Bodhisattva, which is the unity of appearance and emptiness. For our speech, we might think that speech is not something solid, but when somebody uses bad words or attacks us with negative speech, we feel as though we've been physically assaulted. And so as a result, we treat speech as though it were solid and real. But ultimately, our speech is without true reality. So in the Vajrayana, we meditate on mantra, which is the enlightened speech of enlightened beings. Technically, the mantras that were given by the Buddha as he told the stories and the sutras of all the great bodhisattvas and the activity of all the great bodhisattvas, he also gave their mantras. The mantras that the Buddha gave in describing the awakened bodhisattvas and the sutras, those mantras that he gave, were often evocative of the name of that particular Buddha or bodhisattva, and were a way of invoking the power of that Buddha or bodhisattva, or evoking or invoking the essence of that Buddha or bodhisattva. For Tara, the bodhisattva of compassionate action, Tara, Om Tare, Tu Tare, Ture Soha, that mantra is associated with her name. And so the name Tara has to do with Om Tare, Tu Tare, Ture Soha. Soha is like, so be it. Om is a sacred sound that starts many of the mantras, evoking the unity of the universe. So Om Tare, Tu Tare, Ture Soha is a way of saying the name of Tara and talking about her qualities. And Chenrezig's mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, or if you pronounce it in Tibetan, Om Mani Padme Hum, is a way of saying Chenrezig's name. Om indicates, this is according to the teaching by Bokar Rinpoche in his book, Chenrezig, Lord of Love. Om has to do with the awakened body of the Buddha. Hum has to do with the awakened mind of the Buddha. And Mani means jewel and Peme means lotus. And so Om Mani Padme Hum is a way of saying Chenrezig, because in iconography, he's depicted as holding a jewel and a lotus flower. The jewel is symbolic of our Buddha nature, which if we bring it to fruition, is then like a wish-fulfilling jewel of legend, that if you possess this wish-fulfilling jewel, you can have all you desire. Well, if we uncover the basic nature of our mind, the world will become all that we need. And so that's why the Buddha nature is symbolized by the jewel held by Chenrezig. The lotus flower indicates Chenrezig's action in the world. He is rooted in the world, but not stained by the world, just like a lotus flower grows out of ugly mud, but the flower above it is stainless. So the bodhisattva lives in this world, but isn't stained by it. So Om Mani Padme Hum is a way of saying the name of Chenrezig. So if we meditate upon this mantra and we think while we are meditating and reciting the mantra, if we think of the mantra as being sound and emptiness united, it's like an echo, you know, you can hear it and yet there is no solidity to it. If we meditate and we use our malas and say our mantras, if we recite this mantra in this way, and meditate on the sound of our voice as being the sound of emptiness and primordial wisdom, sound and emptiness, then eventually we might come to a realization, and the realization that we come to is that complete purification of speech, which is then realizing the inseparability of sound and emptiness, the unity of sound and emptiness. And then lastly, our mind. We usually think of our mind as being solid and real, and we relate to the things that arise in our mind as though they were solid and real. This is why people say things like, I got mad at myself because I didn't like that person, and I thought I shouldn't be mad at that person. It's bad to be mad, and so on. And so the very fact that our thoughts can provoke us to harm ourselves or harm others means that we don't really see our thoughts as arising from this stream of being that is our mind. We don't see it like that. We think of them as being solid and real. But what if, when we were practicing this visualization of ourselves as having a body made of light and empty inside, and what if by thinking of our speech as emptiness and sound united, body is form and emptiness united, speech is sound and emptiness united, and the whole process, the whole thought process behind it all could be thought of as being the unity of awareness, of our awareness and emptiness. If we then can meditate on the nature of our mind as the unity of awareness and emptiness, then for the short period of time that we are doing the mantra meditation, visualizing ourselves as a bodhisattva made of light and empty inside, reciting the speech of the deity, Om Mani Padme Hum, or Om Tare Tu Tare Turi Soha, or any of the other mantras of the great beings, and then relating to the entire process of the as being the unity of awareness and emptiness. This is a way of training ourselves to purify our notions, our erroneous notions about body, our erroneous notions about speech, and our erroneous notions about mind. It helps to disperse our fixations. And so, even if it's just the practice of our imagination, if it's just the practice of our imagination, imagining that we're a Buddha, reciting the mantra and resting our mind in awareness, even if it is just, still a form of samsaric imagination, you can't say that about the completion stage or the fulfillment stage. Kairim, or the development stage, is where we develop this picture of ourselves as a Buddha made of light. We develop this understanding of the mantra as being the sound and the sound of the sacred, the sound of awakening mind. And we develop this sense of our thought process as being awareness. We develop this, I guess you could call it a mirror world of awakening, that we see as being the basic nature of this confused world that we have. And what do we do at the end of this meditation? What is the fulfillment or the completion of this? In the completion or fulfillment stage, we take this imaginary world that we've built, the pure realm of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, our pure form as the form of a Buddha, our speech as the pure speech of the Buddhas, and our thoughts as the pure mind of the Buddhas. We take all of that and imagine that it all gradually dissolves into our hearts, and that from that moment when it reaches and touches and becomes one in our hearts, we then imagine that it disappears completely and we rest our mind in its own empty, luminous nature. And that is the fulfillment or the completion stage of meditation, resting our mind in itself, resting our mind in its own awareness. And by doing this, we collapse all notions. We collapse the confused notions. We collapse the momentarily engendered awakened notions. And we dissipate all of confusion into just the current moment of mind's awareness. And in so doing, we have the potential to awaken to the nature of all things in that moment. Now, those of you who have practiced mantra meditation know that the dissolution stage, or the fulfillment stage, or the complete stage, whichever of these terms you use to describe it, only lasts for a few seconds. And then our usual discursive, dualistic, samsaric mind, machinery of samsaric fixation begins again. But what are we taught in creation and completion meditation to do next, we're taught in that moment to recreate ourselves as a Buddha, to recreate all sound as mantra, to recreate all thought as enlightened awareness. And so the situation is not ending. The situation is dynamically continuing. In other words, first we're ordinary, then we imagine that we are blessed by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and we become the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, visualizing ourselves as empty and made of light, and that our speech is the speech of the Buddha, which is sound and emptiness, and our thought is awareness and emptiness. And then we take that construct and we dissolve it into our hearts and then into utter emptiness, resting there for a moment. Then instantly when dualism reasserts itself, our habits of dualism reassert themselves, we instantly re-arise as the Buddha or Bodhisattva of practice. And our body is once again the body of a Buddha. Our speech is once again the speech of the Buddha. And our thought is has the nature of awareness. And by training ourselves in this way, using these concepts, we use the concepts to go beyond concept. Kempo Kartha Rinpoche once described the work of Dharma as starting out with bad habits of fixation, replacing them with good habits of fixation, and then slowly going beyond all habit altogether. And so this is a little bit about how mantra practice can evoke growth in us. It can allow us to have a sense of our Buddha nature, allow us to conceive of ourselves as being worthy of respect, conceive of ourselves as being potential Buddhas, and seeing the world in a completely different way. So that's what I wanted to talk about today, was that mantra is a way of connecting to the sacred that is the nature of all things. It's said that a person who is practicing mantra as their main practice walks through this world every day thinking that everything they see is an expression of the mind of the Buddha, the trees, the streets, the houses, the people, they're all an expression of awakening. Now, this doesn't mean that people who are practicing this don't look both ways before crossing the street. Please look both ways before crossing the street. And when you go out these days, in these days of the COVID pandemic, do wear a mask, do cover your face. And so we're not thinking about ignoring pragmatism here. We're thinking about changing our confusion into a path that is more like our mind than it is unlike our mind. So thanks for bearing with me today through this conversation about mantra. And especially those of you on YouTube had to watch me try to figure out how to get on Facebook Live. Thank you for your patience. And it's my hope that these sessions will help you out. And there will be another talk next week, and it's going to be on the topic of patience. I think that's something we all need right now. So we're going to be talking about the virtues of patience next week. It will be on the Columbus KTC Facebook page, and it will also be on my personal YouTube page. Lastly, I want to remind everybody that this coming Wednesday, to benefit the Columbus KTC rebuilding campaign, I'm going to be doing a summer book club Wednesday nights for 6 Wednesday nights, starting this coming Wednesday, the 22nd of July, on the topic of the Great Path of Awakening, which is a Mahayana text teaching the practice of Tonglen, or sending and receiving, and how we can enact that practice in everyday life. You can go Bright and type in transforming emotions, and hopefully it will bring up this, and then you can register online. I know that the Eventbrite system has been frustrating for some people. So if you have problems, you can write to me at LamaKathy, LamaKathy, at columbusktc.org. So let's dedicate the merit of our session today to all suffering beings and make the aspiration that all beings are free from their suffering and come to happiness. I'll recite the prayer in English. Through this merit, may all achieve the omniscience of Buddhahood. May it defeat our common enemy, wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may we free all beings. May we free all beings. May we free all beings. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.